From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Timothy Egan won the National Book Award for Nonfiction last month. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about his award-winning book, The Worst Hard Time. It's about the Dust Bowl years of the 1930s, when mountainous clouds of topsoil were blown over the Great Plains, blackening the skies, causing people and animals to choke to death. Also, we talk with Stephen Kiernan about his new book on how inadequately the medical system is dealing with the end of life. He says that as people are living longer, they're dying slowly of chronic illnesses, enduring long periods of declining health. The medical system has not changed with the times. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Timothy Egan, won the National Book Award for Nonfiction last month for his book about the Dust Bowl called The Worst Hard Time. They were called dust storms, but they were really storms which blew enormous clouds of topsoil through the air, as much as 300,000 tons in one day, blackening the skies and making it impossible to breathe. The dirt was swept up by the wind as a result of misguided agricultural policies, bad environmental practices, and a long drought. More than 250,000 people fled the Dust Bowl in the 1930s. Egan's book is about the people who stayed and endured the storms, witnessing its consequences. Egan writes that at its peak, the Dust Bowl covered 100 million acres of the Great Plains. The epicenter included parts of Texas, Oklahoma, New Mexico, Colorado, Nebraska, and Kansas. 100 million acres of grassland, an area roughly the size of Pennsylvania, was destroyed by the dust storms. Timothy Egan, welcome back to Fresh Air, and congratulations on the National Book Award. And I have to say, my reaction to reading your book was, how come I never paid more attention to this story? It is such an interesting and important part of American history, and it's so kind of relevant to things today. So let me start by asking you to say, describe what the dust storms looked like.
What the dust storms were like in the 1930s when they reached their peak, particularly on days like Black Sunday, which was the worst storm of all time, people would describe it as a moving mountain range. You'd look off and you'd see, 20, 30, 40, 50 miles off on the horizon, this thing that was 100 miles, 200 miles long, perhaps some of them topped out at 10,000 feet high. So that's higher than most mountains in all of the East Coast. And it's moving. So you see this thing from the distance, and then it gradually approaches you. And as it gets closer, all kinds of strange things happen. The static electricity increases. Birds start to screech and flee. And then when one of those storms finally hits, it would go as dark as midnight. It would go completely black. And people would say time and again they could not see their hand when this mountain of movable dust was upon them.
And what was in the dust?
Well, these are really fine particles, and that's why so many people died of something called dust pneumonia. It was a unique term unique to this period. A kid would be sitting in class one day, and then a few days later he'd be missing from class, and then his parents they'd have him in one of these triage hospitals, and they'd find out he was coughing up his lungs, and the kid would eventually die of what they called dust pneumonia. But basically what were in these storms, and let me just give you one comparison here. A single storm, Black Sunday, which I mentioned, April 14th, 1935. That storm carried as much dirt in that day as was dug out of the Panama Canal over 7 years. So, the volume you're talking about is just extraordinary. There was an earlier storm that stretched for 1,400 miles. This was a storm in 1934 that covered New York City, Washington, D.C., and sent dust out to ships at sea. And what was it were in these storms was basically the prairie, what was left of the prairie topsoil of the southern Great Plains. So it was carrying the sort of calcified remains of the southern Great Plains, what had been the greatest grassland in the world.
For your book, you found people who survived the dust storms and stayed in the Dust Bowl. They didn't flee. Are there many survivors left?
Well, because John Steinbeck's book, The Grapes of Wrath, is so iconic, I mean, every kid in middle school reads it now. There have been so many plays. There have been terrific Hollywood versions of it. It's really well known abroad as well. The Grapes of Wrath seems to define the Dust Bowl. But in a larger sense, it does not, because Steinbeck wrote entirely about the people who left, those so-called Okies and Arkies. And most of those people weren't from where the dust storms were. They were tenant farmers from further east, and they were being run out because they didn't own the land. There was nothing for them to do. The people at the heart of the Dust Bowl, they owned their little piece of dirt, so they stuck around. And two-thirds of them, Terry, two-thirds of them in the epicenter of the Dust Bowl, which is about a five-state region covering an area of about 100 million acres, two-thirds of those people did not go. Now, their story is almost gone. These people are in their upper 80s, their mid-90s. They're frail and in nursing homes, and a lot of them still live in these homesteads, these mummified homesteads, and they have these memories, and they have these diaries, and they have these pictures. and you go into their house and you talk with them, and then you have one of these magical moments where they go back and get the shoebox, and the shoebox holds letters and pictures and things that tell the story. So they are still with us, barely, and they just have an amazing story to tell. And that was my challenge, was to try to sort of be the bridge from their story to a more modern audience.
Would you tell us one of the stories that you learned about what it was like to live through a storm? Where would they take shelter? What would they do to try to prevent themselves from breathing in all of the dust?
There was one storm in a town called, it looks like it's Boise City, but it's actually pronounced Bois City is the way they pronounce it. And that's in the Oklahoma Panhandle, an area that was known for about 50 years as, it was formerly known, it was stamped on the map as no man's land. It was arguably the last place in the contiguous United States to be settled. And almost overnight at the start of the 20th century, these towns, you know, propped up and people homesteaded there because it was the last place where you could get a large piece of dirt for basically for nothing. So they had a prosperous time. And then when the storms started to come, they had a horrific time. And during these storms, they didn't know how to behave because there was no institutional memory. There was no one that could say, well, when this happens, go into the cellar. So everyone sort of adapted. The main thing starting was you wouldn't touch another human being because the static electricity was so great. And there was a storm in 34. I remember someone described this to me. This man went outside to look for his little girl, just as they could see the cloud moving in, the cloud, the big dust storm. And then it hit, and everything went black, and he lost sight of his little girl. And he hit the ground, and he said there was about 6 to 12 inches of breathable air on the ground, and everything above him was black and swirling dirt. So this abrasive, they always said it felt like sandpaper on the skin. So he crawled along the ground for about 20 minutes until he found his house. He crawled in this sort of crawl space of 6 to 8 inches of air until he found his house, and he stumbled inside. And then he thought he'd lost his little girl. Well, it was about a day later where he found her. She had been no more than a quarter of a mile away, and she had huddled in a corner in a barn. But people used to actually wear, I heard this from so many people, they would wear these little lifelines. They would attach a rope to themselves sometimes before going out into the barn when a storm was approaching. It was like being in space, so you'd have at least a tether to the place that you're attached to.
So did the child survive?
The child did survive, but on Black Sunday, there was a similar incident that happened outside of Elkhart, Kansas, where a child was lost, and the parents went and gathered their neighbors in the middle of the storm, and they looked, and they looked, and they looked, and they didn't find them. And the next morning, they did find the child. The child had died. It suffocated to death, and the child was only about 800 yards from his home. That was in Elkhart, Kansas.
Did you hear a lot of stories like that?
You did. And that's why they were so afraid. I mean, they didn't know what was going on. Life could be snuffed out. The dust pneumonia part of it, in some ways, they were more afraid of that than the storm. Because the storm was a big brute thing. You could see it coming, and you could dampen down your windows and go lay down and wait for it to pass over the house. But the dust pneumonia thing came like a tap of death on the shoulders. There's a detail that I describe in the book where a young man, 18 years old, 17 or 18 years old, goes in to see a doctor. He's a strapping farmhand type. And he starts coughing up all this dirt. He goes in to see a doctor, and the doctor looks inside of him. And I'll never forget this. He said, "Young man, you are just filled up with dirt." And the kid died 2 days later.
There are journals that you reprint in your book that describe face masks and putting Vaseline around your nose, and you know, rashes that develop. Give us a sense of like the medical precautions, like the homemade medical precautions that people tried to use.
The most common thing that people did, and this was almost universal to people living in the Southern Plains, and I still get it in the letters that I get from people now who say, "Oh, thank you for telling this story. I remember doing exactly that." You wouldn't leave the house without putting Vaseline in your nose. They thought that was a way to sort of trap the particles from going any further. Or with a mask, they would wear anything from a rag to just a sort of kind of surgical mask. People wore goggles as well. Your skin would get incredibly irritated because I described it earlier as being like sandpaper. So there, a lot of people broke out in rashes. And then, okay, that's leaving the house. Then you get in your car and you go to drive somewhere. most people would have a chain that they dragged underneath their car so that the static electricity when one of these storms hit would be channeled through the car and down to the ground. It would essentially ground the electricity. And if you didn't, you know, what the chain did was it kicked up more dust, so it actually made it worse, but it did ground the electricity.
You know, when you describe how bad the static electricity was, I mean, you said you wouldn't even touch another person. Is that because you'd get a shock or you'd get electrocuted? I mean, what are we talking about?
No, you'd get a shock, but it was a very strong shock. Mm-hmm. The first time when I was initially into the research here, this old man told me about, you know, you just wouldn't shake anyone's hand sometimes when a storm was approaching. I said, oh, come on. It just sounded apocryphal to me. Like a lot of these stories, they sounded apocryphal. They sound, you know, people always say, oh, that was the worst ever, or that, you know, you should have been, when I was a kid, I walked in the snowstorm 20 miles to school. But you hear it enough to realize it was true. And what would happen when the static started to crackle through, it's just a really strong shock, and it could knock you back.
My guest is Timothy Egan. His book about the Dust Bowl is called The Worst Hard Time. Egan covers the West for the New York Times. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Timothy Egan, and he covers the West for the New York Times. His latest book, The Worst Hard Time, The Untold Story of Those Who Survived the Great American Dust Bowl, won a National Book Award for Nonfiction in November. It took a while for scientists and other experts to figure out what was causing these dust storms. There was a 1936 report to President Roosevelt from the Great Plains Drought Area Committee. And this committee blamed the dust storms on, quote, an attempt to oppose upon the region a system of agriculture to which the plains are not adapted. The plains had been Indian territory where buffalo roamed, and after the Indians were defeated, the buffalo were basically killed to make room for cattle. Would you tell us that story?
Yeah, it's an amazing story. Also, that report is incredible because it was a real big deal. For these people to basically blame it on government policy and homesteading, the Sacred Homestead Act, which was the key to Jeffersonian agrarian democracy, that the ever westward movement, free land. And they said all that was at the root of that. We never should have farmed this grassland. But it's interesting to look at the land itself. And that's why I see this story, Terry, in some ways as a fable. It's a natural world fable. You start with the greatest grassland in the world. It evolved over eons. I mean, you have this wonderful waist-high blue stem. You'd see it as, I described it as when the wind was blowing on it, like seeing music over the grass. And then you had this tough, resilient buffalo grass, which is much shorter. And this stuff could survive drought and wildfire and incredible extremes of temperature, 120 degrees in the summer on the ground, which is, the ground was actually hotter than that, 137 in some places, or 20, 30 below. But that grassland nurtured bison. And because you had bison, you eventually had people living there. So you had a number of tribes lived fairly well, nomadically, but fairly well on the bison and that fed off this grass. In about 30 years' time, we erased the entire thing. We got rid of all the native people, and then we got rid of all the bison. Now, that's sort of an old story. So at the start of the 20th century, 1900, the U.S. Census took account of the Upper Texas Panhandle, about 25 counties. And you know how many people they found living there after clearing out all the bison, clearing all the native people? Start of the 20th century?
How many?
Zero.
Wow.
it had been completely swept clean. Mm-hmm. And they said, so what do we do with this? What do we do with this? What they did was they enlarged the Homestead Act, so it made it twice as much land as you could get for free. The railroads encouraged people to come out there, and they brought cattle to the land. And cattle were not really suited for it because they're not good thermal regulators like bison. They die in droughts and in really cold periods. Also, and this happened a little later, they decided to plant wheat there, and that was the biggest mistake of all.
Why was planting wheat such a big mistake?
Well, because they overturned the grass. What had held this ground in place was the sod. And even in the driest of years, the sod had this deep root structure, so the prairie would not blow. It was held in place. And what they did is they overturned this sod. They went really deep, a foot into the ground, and overturned it. This is called dryland farming. It doesn't involve any irrigation. You turn over the ground, you put the seed into it, you hope that there's good rains in the spring, and then you harvest in the summer. When the drought came, when these droughts did come, as they often did, the wheat never grew, and so it was never harvested. So the land then started to blow. There was nothing to hold it in place. Also, at the same time, there was a convergence of a commodity thing. There was the wheat had crashed after running up in price after this huge spike. It crashed. It went from like $2 a bushel to $1 a bushel to 50 cents to a dime to nothing. So people were getting nothing. And they thought, you know, in order to get something, well, I at least have to plow twice of what I did. Maybe I can cover my banknote. So it was this convergence of things, you know, planting wheat in what had been grassland. Then the drought comes. The land is not held in place. And then this economic crash, which meant there was this last great frenzy to turn it over one more time. And it all came together, starting around 1931.
Well, before the Depression and the drought, the government was really trying to sell the idea of homesteading, of making it tempting, alluring, you know, to bring people out to the plains. Were people sold a false bill of goods?
I think they were, and I think the government knows that. Some of that was in that 1936 report. It's amazing to think if something like that could ever be written now about Hurricane Katrina or any of the other so-called natural disasters. By the way, one of the points of that report was that this was not a natural disaster, that the Dust Bowl was a man-caused disaster. Now, here's why I have trouble, Terry, though, saying, blaming the people who settled there. And you're nice to not blame them to say they were sold a bill of goods. The people who came here at the start of the 20th century, at the last great and biggest homesteading rush of all time, as it turns out, this was more people homesteaded at the start of the 20th century than had homesteaded before. I call them the last chancers, and they're just a fascinating group of folks. You had Mexicans who sort of always lived there when this land used to belong to part of Mexico. You had a handful of native people, mostly so-called half-breeds, and native people were officially removed from there, and they were not citizens, but some of them still lived in the shadows, and they had a little bit of knowledge of this. And then you had these Germans from Russia who'd been promised that they wouldn't have to be drafted, and they wouldn't be taxed, and they could homestead in Russia. That lasted for 150 years. Then when it was taken away, they moved en masse to the southern plains and recreated exactly what they had on the Volga region in Russia. And then they also had people from the old Confederacy, the so-called poor white trash, or Scots-Irish, who were landless after the Civil War and were sort of adrift across the continent, and they came there as well. So you had all these groups of folks, and I even found some Jewish families as well who moved through there and acted as merchants, all these groups of folks who moved into this blank slate, this tabula rasa, this land that had been utterly erased of its original self and character. Suddenly you had this frenzy, town-building frenzy, start of the 20th century, and they did pretty well, and it was a pretty good thing. I mean, it was like, my God, here's the American dream. These people went from living in these sod houses, from living in these dugouts, which is basically a hole in the ground. I mean, it's amazing to think in the 20th century that Americans lived in basically, you know, coffin-like holes in the ground, these dugouts. You dig a space in the ground, and then the top part of it would be about 4 feet above ground. And then they built frame houses, and then they prospered. So for a while, it looked like the whole thing was really going to work.
Until the drought.
Yeah, this in the 20s, until the drought, until the collapse of wheat prices, too. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Wheat prices to this day have never recovered from what they were in the teens, just after World War I. So it was two things again. Suddenly it was a gold rush for wheat, and then, you know, the prices really went up. And then the drought came as well. And the drought it just asserted the natural character of the southern plains. During the good years, it was wet, so they could actually make it a go of it.
So when you went to the area that had been destroyed by the dust storms, what remnants of those storms could you still see, of the storms and their impact?
Boy, I'll tell you, it's really haunting and really sad for two reasons. I mean, one is you still see, especially in southern Colorado and the panhandle of Oklahoma, so-called no man's land, you still see the drifts. I talk about in the book seeing these fence posts, the nubs of fence posts, barely poking above the ground. Now, these are 12-foot high cedar posts, and what you see when you drive along these little one-lane roads are about 2 feet or a foot of the post above the ground. The other 10 feet are completely buried in dust. And then you see all these abandoned homesteads, and you see schools, and you see the, I describe this in the book, all that's left is the chimney in an old one-room schoolhouse. What's truly haunting is to go to the towns that are trying to hold on. These are towns that America has passed by. I mean, the Great Plains has been emptying of its people for 80 years, since the dust storms. They've never recovered. And they're in an accelerated death spiral right now because there's truly nothing. They haven't found their place in the global economy. So town after town after town in the western and southern plains, they're just trying to hold on.
Are there still dust storms in that area?
There are. And I've gotten quite a few letters from people, and they'll describe Latter-day storms. There were some storms in the 50s, and I ran into a bunch of them when I was down there, but they're nothing. They don't even approach the level of the storms that we had in the 1930s.
Timothy Egan's book about the Dust Bowl is called The Worst Hard Time. He covers the West for the New York Times. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics Edition of A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens, in stores and online at bn.com. And from the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the new Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose, at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
We used to die mostly of heart attacks, strokes, and accidents, writes Stephen Kiernan. Now we die more slowly of cancer, Alzheimer's, and AIDS, but the medical system hasn't caught up to how the end of life has changed. Coming up, we talk with Kiernan about his new book, Last Rites. And we continue our interview with Timothy Egan about the Dust Bowl. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Timothy Egan. He won this year's National Book Award for nonfiction for his book The Worst Hard Time, the untold story of those who survived the Great American Dust Bowl. During the dust storms of the 1930s, the wind blew mountainous clouds of topsoil across the Great Plains. What are some of the policies that remain in place from the Dust Bowl era?
Well, the lasting... they say the most lasting, the greatest legacy of the Dust Bowl, the grassroots legacy, is the Soil Conservation Service, which was started by Big Hugh Bennett, a man of the South, a son of a cotton farmer from the Carolinas. And you still see soil conservation districts all over the West and Great Plains. And the idea there was to get people to knit together and to look at the land as a whole, rather than your square mile against another person's square mile, to look at the entire ecosystem and to say, okay, if you're doing this over here, it's going to blow on my land. Let's look at this thing as a region. Let's look at this thing as a bioregion. So that's been real interesting. And I'll tell you one quick story about how that happened. Bennett was trying to convince the Congress to start the Soil Conservation Service, which, like the national parks, is one thing that the United States gave the world. There's now soil conservation districts all over the world. So he's arguing to Congress, and people are saying, yeah, you know, we've given the Dust Bowl victims enough. These people, what do they know? The thing I mentioned earlier, they're making fun of them. And Black Sunday has already happened, the worst storm in the Dust Bowl period. And it's blowing east, the residue of Black Sunday. So Bennett's going on and on, and his aide comes up to him and says, keep it up. You know, the residue of Black Sunday is about 100 miles away. So he basically goes into this filibuster and starts, you know, telling longer stories. This guy was a great speaker. He could, you know, do these farmer's daughter jokes off the tip of his tongue. Goes on and on and on. Finally, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I think it was a Wednesday in Washington, he says, there it is, gentlemen. That's what I'm talking about. And they look outside and it's dark. And the residue of one of these storms is blowing over and covering Washington, D.C. He goes, there, that's what I'm talking about. There goes part of Oklahoma. Well, that day, the Congress created the Soil Conservation Service. FDR signed it, and it's the lasting legacy of the New Deal. Now, whether it worked or not is another question.
Do you think much about global warming when you think about the Dust Bowl? And I ask that only because the Dust Bowl is, as you know, as the 1936 report to FDR described it, it was a man-made disaster. It was man-made policies about what to do with the land that created this natural catastrophe. And do you fear that, like, something similar is happening with global warming, that there's some kind of, like, natural disaster in the happening, you know, in the making because of man-made policies and man-made actions?
As I said earlier, this story is a fable. It's what happens. It's a story of hubris, and it's a story of human hubris against the land, and it's a story of what happens when you push things, what happens when you don't listen to what the land, the earth, is telling you in its simplest form. And I think that's why a lot of people have responded to this. But I have to say, Terry, you know, I'm generally an optimist. I'm like not black Irish. I'm sunny Irish, I guess. I'm the guy on St. Patrick's Day telling the joke. I don't think we've learned much from this. I mean, the Dust Bowl was largely forgotten. It was, you know, everyone said never again, et cetera, and then it was largely forgotten. I mean, we're pumping deep into the Oglala Aquifer, which some people say it'll lose a lot of its water within 10 to 20 years. And on global warming, I mean, you have a really minor scale model of that in the Dust Bowl. Here's what happens when you don't listen to the trends that are out there. Here's what happens when you push the earth to a certain extent. Did we listen? Do we follow? I mean, unless it's in our self-interest to act in a quick way, it seems like often we don't. So I'm a little pessimistic about it. I mean, I think the parallels are there, and more people bring it up than I do. Virtually every letter I get. I mean, the people who were living in the heart of the Southern Plains in the 1930s, who are dying now, overwhelmingly, I mean, they aren't environmentalists. You wouldn't see them at green conferences. You wouldn't be the kind of people who would be talking, you know, who'd be going to see Al Gore's movie on global warming. They're farm folks who are homesteaders. And they, so many of them told me in their interviews, we knew we made a mistake. We knew we did a sort of crime against the land. We know we pushed it. And so they see this thing as sort of the revenge of the land, too. And I think that's the lesson out of here.
Tell us about one of the most interesting, like, photos or journals or objects, whatever, that you found in people's drawers or shoeboxes doing the research for your book.
A lot of people took sort of, you know, really primitive snapshots of various Black Sunday-like storms in which you saw the barn out back, and then a minute later, and they'd say, no, I took this picture a minute later. The thing was completely black, so it doesn't really show much except for how the storm engulfed it. To me, the most interesting of these sort of real artifacts, these firsthand accounts, was I was in Nebraska, and I found this amazing diary. It's in the book. It takes up three chapters of the book. And it just breaks my heart. It's a diary written by a man. Now, men aren't very emotive, and he does start out with his usual, you know, July 13th, 1935, wind blowing 25 miles an hour. Temperature got up to 76 degrees, not much else to report. So he starts out, you know, typical guy, describes the weather, describes the wind, you know, very non-emotive. And gradually, as time goes on, he starts to describe the breakdown of his marriage and the breakdown of his farm and the breakdown of his life. So finally, this is a man in his 40s. Finally, he's writing in these entries where he's saying, not much left to live for. I love my wife so much, but she has to go to Denver to get a job to work as a maid for a doctor because they're totally broke and the bank is taking their farm. But he refuses to give the farm back, so he sticks behind. And he talks about plowing up the land in spring and his optimism. And then the optimism is totally wiped out by a storm that comes along in June and just sends everything he'd done to the sky, sends it up 10,000 feet high. And so it's a drip, drip, drip. It's slowly this disintegration of a human being. And you'll see in those entries how it goes from, again, just very elemental discussions to a broken heart.
Well, I thought we might close with one of the Woody Guthrie recordings of a Dust Bowl ballad, and I was wondering if you had one that you find particularly good at describing what it was like then.
Do you have, I don't know if you have in your archives, but Woody Guthrie wrote a song at the end of Black Sunday, April 14th, 1935. Woody Guthrie was living in the Texas Panhandle, not far from Amarillo. And this is before he was Woody Guthrie. I mean, he became the Dust Bowl poet, but actually he left the Dust Bowl shortly thereafter. He was plucking around, going from, county fair to county fair. And he said in his biography, he used to sell bootleg whiskey under these little county fair booths. And that's where he learned to play guitar. So he's in this little area outside of Amarillo, Texas, on the day that Black Sunday happens. And they're calling south. They've put in the phone tree. They're saying, this is Kansas City. We just saw this thing. It's 10 miles out and it's headed south. So then when it hit Oklahoma, they start calling Texas. They say, it's coming, it's coming, it's coming. Now it's Sunday afternoon, early evening, and Woody Guthrie's outside and he sees this giant mountain, this just humongous thing coming. He goes inside this little place where he's staying, and he said, there are about 10 people inside this room, and they're all gathered around this one light bulb that's glowing. He said it's like being around the end of a cigarette butt, but they can't see anything. And a woman shrieks out, it's the end of the earth. It's gone. We'll never see each other again. The end is here. The end is here. And he said he wrote a song, So Long, It's Been Great to Know Ya. He came up with the initial lyrics for that song from that Black Sunday.
Well, why don't we end with Woody Guthrie singing So Long, It's Been Good to Know Ya. And Timothy Egan, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you, Terry.
Timothy Egan won the National Book Award for his book, The Worst Hard Time. He covers the West for the New York Times.
I've sung this song, but I'll sing it again. Of the place that I lived on the wild windy plains in the month called April, county called Gray, and here's what all of the people there say. So long, it's been good to know ye. So long, it's been good to know ye. So long, it's been good to know ye. This dusty old dust is getting my home, and I've got to be drifting along. A dust storm hit, and it hit like thunder. It dusted us over, and it covered us under. Blocked out the traffic and blocked out the sun. Straight for home all the people did run, singing so long, it's been good to know ye. So long, it's been good to know ye. So long, it's been good to know ye. This dusty old dust is getting my home. I've got to be drifting along.
Coming up, how the end of life has changed and how the medical system hasn't adequately adapted to those changes. We talk with journalist Stephen Kiernan about his new book, Last Rites. This is Fresh Air. New life-extending medical technology and medicine have also extended the length of time people spend in a downward spiral as they face death. Journalist Stephen Kiernan says the medical system isn't adequately addressing how dying has changed. Kiernan is the author of the new book, Last Rites, that's R-I-G-H-T-S, Rescuing the End of Life from the Medical System. Kiernan wrote for the Burlington Free Press for 14 years as a columnist, editorial writer, and investigative reporter. He received the George Polk Award for Medical Reporting. Stephen Kiernan, welcome to Fresh Air. You write in your book that death used to be sudden, now it's often gradual. How have the leading causes of death changed, and how has that changed what the end of life is like?
Well, 30 years ago, Terry, the leading causes were all sudden: heart attacks, strokes, accidents. And there was a mobilization, really, all across society. Everything from millions of people taking CPR to airbags in cars to E911 service. And those measures, as well as many medical advances, have been enormously successful. Many, many fewer people die of heart attacks and strokes and accidents. But we're all still mortal. And what happens now is that our lives end slowly of things like Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's, Lou Gehrig's disease. AIDS is a leading killer of young adults, and the granddaddy is cancer. Now people's lives end slowly, and that presents really an unprecedented opportunity for people to shape the meaning and content of the last chapter of their lives.
Well, the hospice movement has grown a lot in the past few years, but there are certain trade-offs you have to make if you want Medicare to pay for hospice. What are some of those trade-offs?
Well, there are numerous, and there the two that come to mind that are most difficult are these. A physician has to certify in order for a patient to qualify for Medicare reimbursement for hospice, has to certify that that patient will not be alive in 6 months. Well, one of the problems with that is that doctors aren't trained to know how close someone is to the end of their life, so they're notoriously bad at predicting. The other is that patients and families hear that a doctor is referring them to hospice and they think, oh, the doctor's giving up on me. One more time that the healthcare system is abandoning patients, when in fact moving into hospice is kind of the opposite experience. The other major obstacle is for a person to qualify for hospice care, they have to stop life-prolonging therapies that might have a curative effect. The classic example is a person who's got an organ failure that requires dialysis. Well, they have to choose between going into hospice and receiving dialysis. It's really no choice at all, because if you stop dialysis, you'll be dead in a matter of days, if not weeks. So the result is that there are obstacles built into the qualification for hospice that really scare folks away.
What are some of the more interesting proposals you've heard made about how to reform the guidelines for hospice eligibility?
Well, the first thing is to get rid of the either-or proposition. That is, stop dialysis to receive hospice care or turn down hospice so you can continue your dialysis. The second thing is to take a hard look at the six-month requirement, because there's so much evidence that it doesn't make sense, that it's arbitrary. You know, the third thing would be to take a look and measure the quality of hospice care and contrast it with the quality of the intensive care unit model. But the larger question is, how willing are we to look at how the end of life has changed now and be educated by what we see?
A lot of people don't die in hospice, and they don't die at home. They die in a hospital. What are some of the more interesting changes you've heard suggested for how hospitals could be dealing with the end of life?
Excellent question, Terry, because there's really some cause for optimism there in an idea known as palliative care. Palliative care is a branch of medicine that really is focused on the patient's comfort rather than curing. It's not to say that other medical teams might not continue to work on the cure, but these folks are really concentrating on such questions as, is this patient in pain? Is this patient anxious? Is this patient able to breathe? And then even some of the emotional and psychological components. Does this patient have some relationships that he or she would like to mend in the time that the patient has left? And so that is beginning to look at the patient as more of a person, not just a set of medical problems to be solved. There's been a lot of money put into educating people about palliative care and expanding it. And there have been some hospitals, about a fifth of the hospitals in the country now offer palliative care. And as I say, they are improving, almost taking the hospice model or elements of the hospice model into the four walls of the hospital.
You use as an example of the end of life, your parents' deaths. And you start with your father, who died at the age, I think, of 68 after having an aneurysm.
Actually, he was 65.
65, thank you. And you say your family kept demanding more care, more interventions, more heroic measures. What are some of the things you really wanted your father to have after he had the aneurysm?
Oh, let me draw a contrast for you, Terry. When he first had the surgery, his breathing tube was inserted in his mouth. And after a span of 5 or 6 days, his lips were split and cracked and his tongue was swollen and very white and sore and dry, so much so that my mother was actually standing by his bed, dipping her pinky in a glass of ginger ale and swabbing the inside of his mouth because it was so dry. So they decided to do a tracheotomy, in which there's an incision in the neck and the breathing tube is put in there, and then they put some ointment on his mouth. And at the time, we considered this progress. There was never a time that we stepped back and said, what's going on? What is this machine doing? What are the ethics of this machine? What is the purpose of this? What is the prognosis here? We didn't ask any of those questions. It makes me very sad to think about what we did to him with all of the best intentions.
How do you think you would have handled it differently today?
Well, I know how we handled it differently, because 4 years later, my mother was faced with an aggressive small cell breast cancer that spread all over her, and we knew enough to concentrate on different things. And it's not to say that we didn't exert a lot of medicine on her behalf. We did. But there were also limits to that. She was offered a surgery, for example, that a very renowned physician said was her only hope at a cure. It was called a hemiquadrantectomy. And Terry, what they do is this incision starts just below your ear and comes down to the center of your throat and down the center of your chest and then back under your arm. And everything outside of that incision is removed. And, you know, she was never going to button a shirt again or, you know, I mean, an incredibly disfiguring, disabling surgery. And when that was presented to us as her only hope for a cure, you know, she patted the doctor on the hand and said, thanks very much. And she went home and went Christmas shopping, even though it was September, and began to make preparations for a different path that enabled us all to be around with her. She died in her bed with family at her bedside, her prayer book in her hand, her pain managed. It couldn't have been more peaceful.
My guest is journalist Stephen Kiernan, author of Last Rites, Rescuing the End of Life from the Medical System. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is journalist Stephen Kiernan. He's written a new book called Last Rites, Rescuing the End of Life from the Medical System. Well, a lot of people do have DNRs, do not resuscitate orders, which basically says if they're going to die, don't go through extreme life-saving measures like a ventilator or a feeding tube, you know, if death is looking inevitable. Do you think that those aren't handled well enough, or that not enough people have them? Are they respected once you have one?
Boy, there's a lot of layers to that. Terry, DNRs in particular are respected, and the reason they are is that it's not something that the patient demands. It's an order that a physician signs into the patient's chart, and it's usually marked on the door at the foot of the bed so that people know if the patient's heart stops, that that the medical team will not do all they can to resuscitate them. And that's really, you know, not end-of-life care. For a person with a DNR, it means their heart has stopped, their life has ceased. And so it's really about, are we going to try and bring them back, and what kind of measures are we going to take to bring them back? There was a almost hilarious piece of research that was done on this where the researchers watched a year worth of seasons of the main television programs that are about hospitals, and you could name them all, I'm sure. And they found that 67% of the people whose heart stopped were recovered miraculously. They got that jolt on the chest, and they got a little adrenaline in their bloodstream, and, you know, 32 minutes later at the end of the program, they're up and headed home. The reality is about 1% of the people who have those extreme measures survive them. And about half of that 1%, the brain damage is so acute that they never really regain any kind of function at all. Now, if you sit down with somebody and say, this is an illness that could lead to your heart stopping, and we could do this procedure, and if you want us to, we will, and we will do our utmost to bring you back when your heart is stopped. But you should know that only about one half of 1% is actually going to recover and have any kind of function. Most people, I think, would say, don't do that to me. When I'm gone, let me be gone. It will be a sad occasion, but that day is going to come someday anyway. Let me be gone. So I think there's some education, and if the education necessary, and if the education happens, then the consumers will make very intelligent choices.
The baby boom is about to create a real bulge in the population of the aging, and that's going to have a lot of healthcare consequences. I'm wondering if you've thought about ways in which you think the baby boom generation might end up consciously or inadvertently changing end-of-life care.
Well, I think that they're learning right now. You know, I learned a little earlier than most because my parents died a little younger than most. But I have many friends who are experiencing this with one or both of their parents right now. And they're learning, and what they're finding is that there's a lot to learn. So, you know, I think that when way before their own time comes, they're going to see by watching what their parents go through. I will tell you that I have a very clear idea about what I want for end-of-life care as a result of my parents' experiences and the huge gap between the quality of one and the other. And one of the things I'll be damned if I will inflict on my sons the kind of dilemmas that were inflicted upon us. You know, we had 7 children in the family and my mother trying to decide whether or not to cease my father's dialysis. That's 8 people, each with a different relationship with a patient, each with a different relationship with the health system and science, each with a different relationship with God and with the idea of the afterlife. And we're supposed to reach some kind of consensus. I won't do that to my sons. I've got very clear instructions so that they are absolved from that kind of ethical dilemma, because there is no right answer when you're in that kind of situation.
Now, you said you want to spare your sons the kind of difficult decisions that your family had to make about your father. So what else is in your medical directive?
Mine is, I think, one of the realities that was impressed on me in the course of this research and spending so much time with people whose lives were ending and their families, was that I came to accept the fact that I will indeed die. And obviously it's self-evident, but I actually thought about it. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought about how I could protect my sons and my siblings. So I have very specific instructions. I can be kept alive up to 48 hours so that my sons, by any means necessary, so that my sons can say goodbye, and any of my siblings who care to. And then I want everything turned off, and I want to be put in the sun. And I joke with my brother, who has the authority to make these decisions, that if that doesn't work after a little while, he can put a pillow over my head and it's all right.
That's not really in the document, though, is it?
No, that was just in our conversation. But, you know, it actually brings up a serious point, which is that when you put somebody else in charge, then you want to have a conversation with them.
After having, written this book and after having watched the death of both of your parents, do you have a different sense of what it means to keep somebody alive? You know, to have the priority being just do what you need to do to keep them alive for as long as they can be alive.
Well, I think my sense of it is confusion, Terry, that keeping someone alive under any means necessary can be a substitute for looking at reality and doing the most caring thing, which might be not another surgery. It might be a bowl of ice cream. It might be some pain medication. It might be bringing in a person that the patient had conflict with so that they can reconcile. And those opportunities can be so meaningful and rewarding that compared with the passivity of let's have another surgery and we'll cross our fingers and we'll hope for a miracle. Well, you know, miracles do happen, I suppose, but mortality happens too. We're all going to go someday. Sometimes it makes sense to flex every medical muscle, and sometimes the best thing you can do is sit by somebody's side and hold their hand and stay there, and just stay there, and that's what's really needed. That takes a certain kind of compassion and a kind of love and an opportunity for love that is quite new.
Stephen Kiernan is the author of the new book, Last Rites, Rescuing the End of Life from the Medical System. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Embracing the Infidel, Stories of Muslim Migrants on the Journey West by Bezard Yagmayan. From American Jewish World Service, pursuing global social justice through grassroots change, on the web at ajws.org. And from the California Endowment, working to improve the health and health care of California's diverse communities and celebrating 10 years of community health and partnership. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Huda Ahmed is an Iraqi journalist who's been covering the war for American newspapers. She's been awarded the Elizabeth Neufer Fellowship at MIT's Center for International Studies. On the next Fresh Air, Ahmed talks about the dangers she's faced as a journalist and a woman in Iraq. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.